You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website, trinitychurchdenver.org.
In eighth grade, I was a newfound fan of Pearl Jam. And I still am, by the way. We can talk about it all you want. But I was a huge fan of Pearl Jam, and in eighth grade, my friends and I had acquired through late night, midnight phone calls. That's how you used to have to get tickets before the internet. You have to call over and over again to get tickets to concerts. So we called over and over again until we finally got through. And we got tickets to see Pearl Jam in Austin, Texas when I was in eighth grade. It was a glorious, glorious moment. If you know the history of Pearl Jam, it was prior to the hiatus that they went on in touring. It was going to be a great concert. During the kind of preparations to take the trip to Austin, we had arranged with my mother that she was going to drive us being 14 and 15, therefore unable to drive. She was going to drive all of us, our friends, down to Austin, Texas, take us to the concert, and then we were going to then drive back with her. She agreed eagerly. My friends were all excited. We were all going to pile into the giant old Suburban and drive to Texas. Prior to us leaving, my mother put some stipulations onto the road trip. Notably, that during the concert, someone from our party, at various timed intervals, I don't remember the exact intervals, had to walk out of the concert and go check in with my mom, who was not going to be attending the concert since she wasn't a fan of Pearl Jam, which should not reflect poorly on her character. She's a wonderful person. She is even better now, but a wonderful woman. This, as an eighth grader, was a complete insult to my autonomy and individuality and my maturity, that I would have to leave a concert, or worse, tell my friends they had to leave the concert, walk out to my mom's Suburban to wave and let her know that we were still alive and still in there, and then come back, and had to do that periodically, like a number of different times throughout the course of this concert. Well, that was ridiculous. And so we organized a debate with my mother, a negotiation, if you will. First, we started with, hey, let's just pull back. Maybe not every 30 minutes. We'll do it maybe once in the middle of the concert. Intermission, one of us can run out and let you know. No, she was not into negotiating. The goal ultimately was to get this taken off the table completely. She was simply not going to go there. And so for weeks, we would set up kind of ambushes where somebody, one of my friends from my group, would go and try to argue with her about why this is unnecessary. Brian's a very responsible 15-year-old. He'll be great. He'll keep watch over us. Nope, she wasn't into negotiating. I would come and complain about how it just really exhibited, I don't know if you've ever heard this, parents of teenagers, it just really exhibited a lack of trust in me and my upbringing that I'd received from her. And this is ridiculous. Whatever the thing was, there was multiple angles on this negotiation. And my mom finally sat all of us down and said, look, we're done talking about it. We're not doing any more negotiations. This is how it's going to work. Every 30 minutes, somebody from the group has to come out, let me know you're okay, and then you can go back in. If you want me to drive you down, this is how it's going to happen. We continued to press her, as 14-year-old and 15-year-old boys are apt to do. So she called another meeting, and at this meeting she said, I'm not going. You can go if you can find someone else to take you, but I'm not driving you. And we were stuck then with a problem that Paul has been trying to get us to see for quite some time. A problem that confronts us in the book of Romans in a way that kind of flips our understanding of the problem with the world upside down. You see, we talk often about the problem with man abandoning God, man turning away from God, refusing to follow God, refusing to obey God, refusing to trust God. And we do so rightly. That is, in fact, a problem. It's a problem that's spoken often of in the scriptures. But what we rarely are confronted with is the far, far more serious problem of what if God were to look at us and say, you're not my people. But what if God were to look at us to say, you are not loved? You see, we talk often about the nature of sin. We focus on the volition of man, the actions of man, the will of man. But Paul in Romans, from the very beginning, starting in verse 18, has confronted us with a far more grave issue. What if God has rejected us? What if, as he says in Romans chapter 1, he said enough is enough and he has walked away, handing us over to our own desires, our own sins, our own attempts to make the world what we want the world to be? This is the problem that Paul wants to set in front of us in Romans chapter 9. It really is fundamentally the problem that lays at the bottom of understanding everything, all of that controversial stuff we talked about last week. To really understand what God is up to in the salvation of the world, in the redemption of a people, and how he's gone about it. If you lose sight of this first issue, this first and fundamental problem that was first given to us or presented to us all the way back in Romans 1, then pretty soon you'll stop seeing the beauty of what was set out for us in the previous two paragraphs, and you'll stop seeing the glory of what it is that God has actually accomplished for us. And so what I want to do for us this morning is Paul is going to set out for us two sets of quotations from Isaiah and Hosea to explain kind of historically and from the Old Testament what God has accomplished, what God is actually doing through the work that he's accomplished in Jesus and in redeeming and calling a people to himself. And so we're going to look at how he's using that, how these two quotations, these actually four quotations, actually pull together threads that we've been chasing down, like a year and a half now, since we started Romans, not last fall, but the fall before last. And how God pulls all those things together as a way of kind of revealing to us this week the nature of God's salvation. What is the gospel? What has God done in our salvation? And so to do that, I want to kind of remind you of where we've been in Romans and how this is kind of the next step in a progression that Paul's been walking through in this chapter. He began by confronting us with a problem, and it's namely this, that those who'd received the promises of God, the laws of God, who had the whole history of God's redemption, they were the people that God had set apart and he had spoken through and for and to, all the promises of the coming of Jesus and what God intended to do for the world. He had given it to a people called the Jews. He'd given it to the Jewish people, and yet they, standing at this moment in history, had largely rejected the promises of God. They largely rejected the coming of Jesus to redeem and rescue his people. In other words, Paul's confronting us with the issue that here is millennia of history declaring to us the intentions of God and the glory of God and the promises of God and the nature and the character of God. And yet the Jewish people had received all of that, had passed all of that down, and yet when the time came for all of those promises, all of that law, all of that wisdom to be fulfilled, to actually be manifest in front of them, they rejected it. So that problem confronted us in the first section of Romans chapter 9. But then he begins to solve that problem for us. And he begins by making that problem just a little bit worse, as Paul's apt to do. And the way that he makes that problem just a little bit worse, he says, look, God is not bound either to you at your ethnicity, kind of your ancient pedigree, where you've come from, your genetic code. None of that, when you bring that to the table with God, binds him to anything. Just because you can, through your ancestral tree, track it all the way back to Abraham, does not mean that God is somehow chained or enslaved or bound to save you. And second, the other way that he makes the problem worse is that God's salvation, his redemption of a people, his mercy, is not based on him perceiving in you that you're better than someone else. That you should not understand the redemption of God, the salvation of God, what God is up to through the work of Jesus and redeeming a people that somehow he looked out and decided, Nader Hearn someday is going to do these good things and it's going to outweigh these bad things. In fact, he probably doesn't even really do any bad things. He's just good. He's so good, in fact, that I'm going to save him. So Paul says, look, you're misunderstanding the nature of salvation when this is a problem for you. You're believing that somehow your parents or your grandparents, somehow is that their lives, that their religiosity or their morality somehow binds God to benefit you in some way. And you believe that somehow your good works become the means by which you warrant the grace of God. You warrant the salvation of God in your life. This is not how God saves people. Which then brought us to last week, which no one brought me a person. 2 weeks ago, I had a little sculpture made of a person holding onto their hat. The week prior to that, we had a drawing. Last week was like the hold onto your hat week. That the central thing in understanding who the people of God are, if you're in this room and you believe in Jesus, if you're in this room and you love the grace of God, if you're in this room and you trust all that he says and you long to obey him and know him and love him, if there's any inclination in you at all towards God to trust in Jesus, that is not owing to your own wisdom. It's not owing to your own cleverness. It's not owing to your own humility. It's not owing to your own ancestry. It is owing completely and utterly to the sovereign call of God that he spoke and awakened in you a desire to see him, to know him, to trust him, to hear him. That the mercy of God is rooted not in any obligation that God has towards us, that he is free, and he bestows mercy where he bestows mercy. But it's not arbitrary. It follows a particular purpose, and that's where this is where Romans 9 is going to take us into today. And that purpose, he tells us in verse 23, is in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he's prepared beforehand for glory. Remember that the whole direction of Romans 9 is headed to Romans 10 and eventually to the great conclusion of Romans 11, that from him and through him and to him are all things. That nothing originates with us. His mercy, his grace, his kindness. Any semblance of righteousness or holiness in your life is gift. A gift freely given by God to his people. So that as we look out at the salvation that's been purchased for us, all we can do is say thank you. All we can do is worship. All we can do is respond to the sovereign mercy of God given to us, not because we deserved it, but because he's kind. And he wanted to demonstrate for us, to show us his glory. The glory of his justice, the glory of his wrath, and, thank God, the glory of his mercy. And then here's the next step in Paul's argument. Who are these vessels of mercy? Who are these ones who get to see and enjoy and marvel at forever the riches of God's glory? Glory, by the way, it's a religious word we use all the time. We use it after football games. We use it in church. We use it in prayers. We use it all the time. What does glory mean? It simply means kind of the public display of the characteristics of God. So he wants to demonstrate for us. He wants us to see as he's acted in history, bestowing mercy and wrath, the full range of his character, his beauty, who he is. Now, who is that we? Paul says, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. This feels obvious to us today, sitting 2,000 years later. But it wasn't obvious to anyone in the world in Paul's day. That God would have a people that wasn't ethnically defined. That wasn't defined by nationality. Wasn't defined by the color of someone's skin. Wasn't confined to one particular political disposition. But that God would have a people made up of all the nations of the earth called to belong to him. What was brand new, by the way. Oh, we had tribal deities. We had kind of deities that were tied to particular national political groups like the Roman gods. You were expected to serve and worship the Roman gods in addition to your particular tribal deities. But to say, here's one true God, one God that would rule over everyone, no matter what ethnic backgrounds you come from, no matter what political situation you find yourself in, here is the one God who makes claims, and now here, not only makes claims on all the earth, but actually is active in calling to himself, sovereignly, graciously calling to himself people from every nation, every tongue, every tribe. This was brand new. Completely brand new. So Paul wants to explain where this comes from and how this happens. And to do so, he's going to use the Old Testament to kind of throw us back into the first three chapters of Romans. So, Paul says in verse 25, he quotes Hosea. He quotes two different sections of Hosea in these two verses. Quoting Hosea, he says this, "Those who are not my people, I will call my people. And her who is not beloved, I will call beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called sons of the living God." Now, Hosea is a marvelous book. And Paul says that what God is doing right now in the world, what God's doing actually right now in this room, is what God already spoke about doing in Hosea. So what's Hosea about? Hosea was a prophet called by God, and he was actually called by God to marry on purpose a woman that he knew would be unfaithful to him. And yet, as a husband, he was called to remain faithful to her and to offer her mercy again and again and again. That in the sight of her adultery, in the sight of her unfaithfulness to Hosea, he wasn't to cast her out. He wasn't to have her stoned. He wasn't to walk away from her and leave her abandoned. He was to chase after her again and again and again and again. In fact, his life, his marriage was expected to be a picture for Israel of the nature of their relationship to the God who'd saved them and redeemed them and spoken to them. In other words, Israel herself was a people who had been unfaithful, who had chased after other gods, who had been adulterous to her God, her husband, and had walked away again and again and again and again, and God had gone after her again and again and again, gone after her in faithfulness, gone after her in love, gone after her in mercy, pursued her. The nature of the story of Hosea is, here is a people who have walked away from me, a people that I've rejected and said, these are not my people anymore, and yet I'm going to go to them and call them to myself. And in the very place where they were called not my people, where I pronounced judgment on them and on their abandonment of me, and I had rejected them, I'm going to call them back to myself and call them my people. In the very place where they had not belonged to anyone, I will lay claim on them again and they'll be mine. Now, what Paul does with that story is to now apply it not simply to the Jews, but to the whole world. To a world that, as he describes for us in Romans chapter 1, has refused to acknowledge God or to give thanks to God. A world, a people, societies that refuse to submit to the rule of God. God now comes and says, before where he had said, you are not my people, you don't belong to me. He comes now, and through the work of Jesus, says, "You are my people." He comes to a people without a family, without a home, without a God. And he says to them, "You will be children of the living God." So Paul summarizes for us here the central proclamation of the gospel. It is not that God has made a way of salvation. It is that God has saved. It's not that God has provided a ladder for you that you can climb up. If you climb it up, climb up the ladder, you can find your way into the gospel boat. You climbed your way in. Notice God has reached down into the waters and rescued a drowning person. This is the essence of the gospel. You were rejected. You were under God's wrath. You did not belong to him. You were not beloved. Yet God has declared that you are his. God has called you a son. And he's made you alive. Now, what about these Isaiah quotes? Isaiah is a gigantic book. And for the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, it's some of the darkest reading you'll get to all year if you try to make it your way through a Bible reading plan. And the reason is, for 39 chapters, God outlines his judgment primarily against Israel, but really against all the nations as well. You've refused to obey my law. You've refused to honor my covenant. You've refused to believe the promises that were given to you through the law, through the prophets, through all that I've given you through the patriarchs. You've refused to receive those promises. You've refused to trust those promises. And you've gone your own way. And so for the first 39 chapters, God outlines his rejection of this people, Israel, the judgment of God against them. 39 chapters. And then, starting in chapter 40, he begins to establish a promise that even in the midst of this rejection, that he's not going to cast off and destroy this people utterly, but rather he's going to save out from Israel a people that will belong to him, what's called a remnant. Though right now it looks like the people of Israel are like the sand of the seashore, and they've all gone astray. They've all rejected me. They've all walked away from my law, from my word, from my grace, from my promises. I will not cast them off completely. I will save a people to belong to myself. This is going to be a theme that's going to get further developed in chapter 10 and chapter 11. But the emphasis in Isaiah is on the mercy of God to not utterly destroy this people, but to save out from this people who've rejected him, a people who belong to himself. So there's the Old Testament themes. There's the picture that Paul's trying to draw our attention to summarize the nature of God's salvation, the nature of what God is up to in and through the work of Jesus. What is this all mean? He's pulling us back to understand the nature of our condition prior to the mercy of God. We're not a people who just need a little help. We're not a people who just need a little more education. That the problems facing humanity are not problems that can be resolved by the right government strategies. We won't fix the injustice, the evil, the sin, the corruption that's at work in the world by just giving it more money. The problem we find ourselves in is far graver than that. That the God of the universe, as evidenced by the chaos that surrounds us and actually floods our own lives, he has declared, "You are not my people." He's declared in the midst of the world You are unloved. Now, preachers get paid nowadays to minimize that. It's a way lighter thing, right? If I can just stand up here and say, hey, God is love. He just loves you. He's just waiting there. Like a jilted husband. Waiting for you. If you'll just come back to him. Placing the emphasis again and again and again on this nice and rosy picture of the relationship between humanity and God. But what God says here is there's a point at which he has declared over humanity, you aren't mine. Let the gravity of that land on you. And what we see in society today is the fruit of what it means for a people to no longer belong to God. What it means for a people to no longer be a people. But we have a world that in every possible way is overrun with the autonomous self. Like you and I were made, as Paul points us back in Romans 1, we were made to receive from God our very lives, our identities, our hopes, our dreams, our understanding of what the world was like and what we were for and where we fit into it. We were made to receive from God everything, our understanding of what is moral and immoral, what is ethical and unethical. We're made to receive from God our sexuality. We're made to receive from God our gender. We're made to receive from God how it is that we're supposed to live in the world. We were supposed to go to him and receive from outside of ourselves everything. And having rejected God and having been rejected by God, we build autonomous, tyrannical little selves, running around deciding for ourselves what's right and wrong, what's true, what's false, what's beautiful, what's good. Deciding for ourselves what our bodies are for, what justice is, what we belong to. We self-select into tribes and see a culture overrun with identity politics and the chaos that's ensued. We labor under the weight. Please hear me. It is an unbearable weight. But it's held out everywhere as a promise, a good promise, to try to construct or craft a life that looks the way we want it to look. Constantly trying to present to our neighbors and to ourselves an image of who we think we ought to be. Whether that's kind of the aesthetic version through Instagram or the kind of the constant moral posturing to show that you're on the right side of whatever the thing is. Constantly straining for autonomy. Refusing to look outside of ourselves to receive anything. So we're a people who don't belong to anyone. Scrambling in this world alone, isolated, constantly trying to construct a self and identify a tribe we can belong to, going to war with the other tribe over there. I don't think there's a clear description of the world that we have constructed right now. The one we see unfold in Romans 1, 2, and 3. Casting off God and cast off by God. Doing things that corrupt us, loving things that destroy us. Scrambling to find some identity, to construct some identity, to find some tribe in order to go to war with some other tribe. This isn't like modern sociology. This is ancient Bible. And it is our world. And so we're a people who are not a people, We're a people who desperately long to be beloved. And so we scramble to find people who will affirm us, who will like us enough on Instagram or Facebook, who will affirm us enough because of our success in our job, who will try to find meaning through some sort of like weird, cyclical, sexual identity where I feel loved because I feel my own pleasure in this, whatever this series of relationships might be. We long to be loved and we long to belong and we have been rejected by God and we are unloved and we don't know where to turn, and with the one place where we can turn, we refuse to turn. And the solution doesn't lie within us. The solution for our world doesn't lie within us. We can't pull ourselves together and elect the right person to office, rebuild educational programs, or get more money to fix it. Now, if that's our world, and maybe this morning you're in here and that feels like your life, imagine with me, in the midst of all of that lostness, that chaos, that scrambling to find a people, that scrambling to find love, imagine in the midst of all of it, a voice. A voice calling to you and saying, you who once were not my people, I call you now my people. You who were unloved, I name you beloved. Imagine with me, you're without a family, you're without a tribe, you don't belong anywhere, you are lost, and in the midst of chaos, in the midst of this world, and then a voice comes and says, you once, in this very place, in this very room even, it was declared that you are not my people, but now I call you a son of the living God. This is the gospel. It's not a moral pathway to a more fulfilled life. It's not a kind of new add-on or Instagram filter that you kind of put on your life, like now I can take on this version of Christianity. It's not kind of a pathway to self-fulfillment or a pathway to a more moral and upright life. No, it is a declaration from the living God, the God that spoke everything into existence, the God whose word creates reality. Get that. Who speaks and it is. And he says to a people who are lost and alone and scrambling for identity and searching everywhere for love, you are loved. You have no people, you are my people. You have no family and you are alone in the world, you are my children. This is the gospel. This is the announcement of good news. Oh, that you would receive it, that you would believe it, that you would hear that voice. Not doubt it, but trust it. And from this one who renames you, this one who adopts you and redeems you from slavery, so it takes you from wandering in the wilderness and puts you in his home, that you would hear his voice and marvel. Christianity is not that God has made a way for you to save yourself. It is that God saves. God redeems. God names. God loves. Let's pray.